ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Annabelle Crabb. Now, I wouldn't say I'm a hoarder exactly, but I do hang on to things. It's not just you and me. Australia's oldest library is crammed with stuff that isn't books. Terrible paintings, old menus, human hair. Is this history or hoarding? Come and have a rummage through the story of us, told by our stuff. Search for the History or Hoarding podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
So, Kylie, we often talk about the craziness, the wildness, the unpredictability of US politics, and there's certainly plenty of examples to identify that and say, you know, world's craziest politics, but I think the Philippines really is kind of pushing the limits of what a country can cope with and frankly, what a democracy can cope with.
Yeah, I think when you have, you know, gunfights and gun battles raging in Parliament, it's a pretty good indication that you've reached another level, yet another level of political chaos. I mean, the Philippines is a place where the politics is not a well-mannered affair, right? The steady state of Philippine politics from the days of Marcos into Duterte, into this latest generation of Duterte and Marcos, you know, there is a dramatic edge to this. The military is always involved. It's a very engaged population. And so everything is at a very high temperature all the time. But really, the events of the last week or so have even blown by those standards.
Yeah, so I suspect many listeners probably may not even have seen what's happened, but there has been this extraordinary gunfight inside the parliament building shut down, a senator has effectively disappeared from within that because he appeared to be on the verge of arrest to be taken to The Hague. And, of course, this all comes, as you say, against the backdrop of this sort of indescribable bitter dispute between the Marcos family and the Dutertes. Of course, just to set the scene for listeners, so Rodrigo Duterte, the former president, is now in The Hague facing trial for his role in the war on drugs and obviously the disappearance of so many Filipinas during his time in power. His daughter, Sara, is the current vice president and she serves underneath Ferdinand Marcos Jr., who's the son of the ousted former dictator, Ferdinand Marcos, who, of course, fled with at least $10 billion of Philippines public money in the 80s and was truly disgraced. TikTok and social media, though, has helped Bongbong reclaim the family name and identity and win the election. But since coming to power together, that is Bongbong and Sara Duterte, they've had this almighty falling out. And so the division between these two clans exists within the existing leadership of the country.
As well as Duterte himself, there are lieutenants to Duterte who are on the ICC's list. One of them is a guy called Ronald De La Rosa. He was handpicked by Rodrigo Duterte to be the top cop in the Philippines. He was a very loyal follower of his. He comes from Davao City, from Mindanao, like, you know, which is the power base of the Dutertes. And as we understand it, although our next guest will explain more, the law came looking for De La Rosa. Mm. And that is what prompted these extraordinary hours inside the Senate.
I think it's maybe worth just spending a moment as well, Kylie, exploring why and whether this actually really matters outside of the Philippines. And for me, and I'm kind of keen to explore this with our guest, I do think there's a kind of broader geopolitical dimension that does affect our region, because when it comes to the interplay between China and the United States, the Philippines is a pretty critical piece of the puzzle. And there are disputed waters. The Philippines has probably had more confrontations with Chinese Navy vessels than what other countries in the region have experienced, maybe setting aside the likes of Taiwan and Japan. And actually, these dueling dynasties do have different positions when it comes to dealing with the United States and dealing with China. So Duterte, the ousted dictator now in The Hague, as seen as being slightly more China-orientated, and Bongbong Marcos is seen as being slightly more US and Pacific centric in his focus. Now, there are, I think that's oversimplifying it somewhat, and I'm sure our guests might confirm that. But if you want a kind of simple, straightforward way of thinking about this picture, I think that's a way of considering it. So when all is said and done, you know, whichever one of these families ends up in power does make a difference. And of course, you know, and I'm not sure what the answer to this is, whether or not this Philippines even stays bound together, given the geography of where these families have their power bases, I think might even pose further questions about the way the regional map plays out in the future.
Yeah, and just finally, I think it's also about a question of whether or not the rules of the international system apply within the Philippines, right? We saw that Duterte, of course, turned his back on the International Criminal Court. Marcos has now opened the door to them, at least, you know, in, as a way of disposing, you could say, somewhat cynically, of his greatest political rival. But it seems that they are invited in on occasions when it suits whoever the powers are, but then not if there's any kind of a if it causes a problem.
So, and this is a bit of a technicality, but for listeners who are sort of scratching their heads and thinking, hang on, why and when is the ICC involved? Well, effectively, the International Criminal Court is supposed to step in and has jurisdiction when the country where the alleged crimes have occurred doesn't have a justice system or can't deliver justice through its existing systems. That's where this function occurs of the ICC. And so that's why you get argument about whether it's relevant, for example, for the ICC to step in the instance of, let's just take Israel as an example.
It's fascinating, Hamish, and we can talk some more, but it's time to make room, I think, for our guest, Professor Jose Dalasay. He's one of the Philippines' most respected and best-known literary figures. He's also a political columnist, and he was detained under martial law by the Marcoses. He's affectionately known in the Philippines as the Pen Man. He writes a popular lifestyle column in the Philippine Star.
Jose Dalasay Jr., welcome to Global Roaming.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
And like all good Filipinos, you have a nickname. It's Butch. Do you prefer Butch?
Jose is fine.
in a country where the president goes by the name Bongbong, nicknames are pretty important. Jose, from here, it looks absolutely bonkers in the Philippines right now. How does it look on the ground for you?
Well, things have been pretty crazy over the past week, but then again, that's been the case for the past year in terms of the way Philippine politics has gone. We don't know what's coming up, and there's an impeachment trial for the vice president coming up soon, and we don't even know if that's going to happen, although the Constitution mandates it.
Why is it uncertain if it's so clear? And obviously there's a really long list of things that Sara Duterte is accused of doing. Why would it even be in question?
Because the Dutertes have come up with all kinds of legal impediments to the trial going all the way to the Supreme Court, which incidentally ruled that the word forthwith does not mean immediately, but well, within a reasonable amount of time, which, and time to Filipinos is eminently stretchable.
Jose, it's a kind of engineered chaos, though, isn't it? Am I right in thinking that? So you have these two very powerful characters representing, you know, powerful bloodlines in Philippine politics.
Yes.
And they have lots of tools that they can use in order to complicate the lives of their opponents, whether it be an impeachment or an ICC arrest warrant or even, you know, social media. I mean, they have lots of ways to confuse and bedevil their opponents. Is that what's going on?
Absolutely. Just for the benefit of your listeners here, the Marcoses and the Dutertes were allies on the same side just a few years ago, and they represented two of the most powerful political blocs in this country. And since then, they've fallen apart in very bitter ways. And so this is just a continuation of that Titanic confrontation. And this is going to be a take no prisoners kind of drag down fight. I mean, the Marcuses have sent the Duterte patriarch off to the International Criminal Court in the Netherlands. And I mean, that's it. So Marcos knows that he cannot give the daughter, the vice president, any quarter in this fight. And we expect this to be a very bitter and bloody fight down to the end, except that we Filipinos are left grasping for real leadership and real service while this is all going on.
And what's this doing to democracy in the Philippines as it, you know, tumbles forth day after day? I mean, is it eroding a sense of civil society and a sense that there are real objectives that can be achieved, real policies delivered upon through the political system?
I think it leaves what could have been our illusion of real democracy in tatters, because once again, we are reminded that Philippine politics is really a kind of a Game of Thrones. It's a family feud, and that's been the case ever since we achieved independence from the United States in 1946, and even before that.
I wanted to ask you about that, because something like 20 coup attempts since independence in 46. The bulk of them happened between the mid-80s and then about 2007 when things settled down comparatively. Yes. Is this actually that different? Is the Filipino population somewhat, I guess, used to having this sort of thing happen?
Yes, I think we've been culturally conditioned to accept the leadership of, shall we say, the devil we know, which makes it very, very difficult for a progressive but relatively unknown political leader to break through. And we thought we had that in Leni Robredo a few years ago. And she might still stage a comeback in 2028. And I think this is why the Dutertes are really digging in, because they know that Robredo is the only one who can take them on.
Who is Leni Robredo? Our listeners may not be across her.
Yes, she was the former vice president under President Rodrigo Duterte, and she was left out in the cold by the Dutertes, and she ran for president against Bongbong Marcos and lost to him. But now there's a very strong move to get her back in the running in 2028. All of this is about 2028. The maneuverings at the Supreme Court, because impeachment carries with it perpetual disqualification from public office. So it would automatically knock Vice President Sara Duterte, who's now the leading contender for the presidency, out of the running. So that is what this impeachment is all about. It's about our political future and who's going to lead us in 2028.
Sara Duterte, though, has said on a live stream in 2024, in relation to Bongbong Marcos, she said, "I have talked to a person. I said, if I get killed, go kill BBM." So that's Bongbong Marcos.
Yes.
As well as the First Lady, as well as the House Speaker. She said, "No joke, no joke. I said, do not stop until you kill them."
Right.
Now, she's since slightly walked back that commentary and says it was taken out of context. But how does that not get you impeached? How does that not rule you out of even vying to be the leader of the country?
Absolutely. Well, that's one of, I think, the four or five articles of impeachment that are going to be taken up in the Philippine Senate, which her faction now controls because of the Senate coup that happened last week. I mean, you would think that verbally threatening the president with assassination would be impeachable, but anything in this country is negotiable.
But we do in the U.S., you know, when we're talking about Trump and U.S. politics, yes, we often talk about the strength of institutions.
Right.
And we're very interested in that.
Yes.
So how strong is the Senate at the moment as a body that is able to, for example, hold Sarah Duterte to account or indeed, you know, present a senator who's wanted by the International Criminal Court to the people who are looking for him?
Yes. Well, the Philippines has a bicameral legislature, and the Senate, as in the United States, sits as the higher body of that legislature. I mean, the Philippine Congress overwhelmingly passed the impeachment measure, so it's now up to the Senate to decide on that. The Senate is composed of about 24, well, now down to 23 people, and they are inordinately powerful because of their control of the budget, among other things. Philippine politics is political theater, and the Senate... Senators are actors on a very big stage. And so the people do follow what they say and what they do. So in a sense, they represent many of the differing opinions in this country, among the 23 of them.
Jose, though, can I ask how much impact the disappearance of this senator has then on how the impeachment might play out? Because my reading of it is that it's critical, right? And that
it is.
This really is all interconnected in quite complex ways.
Yes. Well, given the present balance of the numbers in the Senate, that one vote was crucial. So they took him out of hiding just to come in and put in that vote, and they immediately pulled him out again. So he's vanished into thin air.
How does a high-profile senator escape a Senate that's surrounded by national police and, was it special forces even? You know, like very heavy militarized security presence there. And somehow he slips the net and no one knows where the guy is?
You know, this comes straight out of Hollywood. Smoke and mirrors, gunfire, supposedly a wig worn by a bald man.
Really?
Well, somebody was waving a wig after he left. So, he couldn't make this up.
They call him Vin Diesel, don't they? Because he's bald.
Yes, absolutely. And now he's reputed to be somewhere in Mindanao, which is of course the bastion of the Duterte. So God knows where we'll find him, if ever.
I'm Kylie Morris with Hamish McDonald on Global Roaming, and we're speaking with Jose Dalace about political unrest in the Philippines, still to come, why it matters to the world and our region.
Jose, is it possible that this long-running dispute between the Dutertes and the Marcoses, given that, as you say, the Dutertes have a very powerful stronghold in the south.
Yes.
Rodrigo Duterte himself won election from The Hague as mayor of Davao City last year. Is it possible that this could lead to like a breakup of the Philippines?
There's been a long-running secessionist movement in Mindanao to begin with. So that's always been on the table, except that it's never really prospered. And of course, there's been resurgent talk of that. It's not only coming from the far right, but from Mindanao secessionists themselves. I mean, Muslim insurgents. This has been going on since the Spanish times, back in the 19th century.
And what about the geopolitics of this? I mentioned it at the top of the program, and I hesitate because I think it is possible to really vastly oversimplify it. But there is a view in the region that Bongbong Marcos tends to lean more towards the US and that Duterte was willing to lean more towards China. Is that how you see it? Is that too simple?
Well, I think that's generally accurate because Duterte practically sold us out to the Chinese. I mean, and I must say that initially he had very strong backing from Philippine nationalist and even liberal forces for seeming to take an independent foreign policy, only for us to realize that independence meant giving up our rights in the South China Sea to the Chinese. And so that was a huge revelation for us. And now there's actually a resurgent sentiment of a felt need for some kind of American support in case China encroaches any further on our territory.
Jose, you were imprisoned under Ferdinand Marcos, and
yes.
You're one of the country's experts on martial law. I mean, what's happening to people's political rights while all this confusion is going on?
I want to know if you've forgiven the Marcoses. Like,
I think that you will find that there is now a very strange and uneasy alliance between the sun and the more liberal or progressive forces in this country, because we know that if we don't form even the shakiest kind of coalition, Sara Duterte will prevail in 2028.
Jose, what happens, do you think, to people like you, to Maria Ressa, the Nobel Prize winner, founder of
yes.
Rappler, which is an independent media
yes.
Organization? What do you think might happen to you if Sara Duterte gets in a few years?
Well, we'll
get
be
disappeared?
Back to, we'll be back to where her father took us a few years ago. The media will once again be silenced through both legal and paralegal ways. We expect to be back in the trenches. Those of us in the media and literature and in the arts will be fighting the same fight all over again. But you see, as I often say, we've been through martial law. So we've been through all this, and we know what we're up against, and we're ready to fight back against whoever sits there and turns out to be another despot.
Jose, if the process is followed and Sara Duterte
yes.
is impeached, what
yes.
does that mean? Is that the end of her political career? Is that how it's meant to work?
Well, that will disqualify her from running for president, but... who knows? I mean, if she's brave enough to say publicly that she will have the president assassinated, I wouldn't put it beyond her to stage a rebellion or some kind of coup, some kind of extra legal a response to her being shut out of the electoral process. So anything here is in the cards.
Jose, it's been really interesting chatting to you. We can't wait to find out what happens in this cliffhanger.
Yes, me too.
Stay safe, Jose.
Well,
thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Well, that was author, poet, and columnist, Professor Emeritus Jose Dalisay Jr., talking to us from the Philippines. Kylie, what did you make of it?
Well, I'm still worried. I don't think he reduced any of my concerns. And also, sometimes understanding what's behind the chaos doesn't make it any better. And you do have this terrible rivalry, which on one hand it feels as though the Philippines is being held hostage by. But some of his terms, you know, calling it a Game of Thrones, talking about this clutch of 23 very powerful senators who can really decide the political future.
A couple of things I would say that I was reflecting on during the conversation, Kylie. One is that, you know, we live in this time where there are a lot of questions about those who lead countries that do immense harm can ever be brought to justice. And the fact that Duterte is in The Hague is something that we shouldn't look past. So that's one component. I think the other thing is that we're sort of accustomed to often viewing these sorts of things, you know, high drama in a parliament, etc., just within the domestic context of a country and its near neighbourhood. I think the realities of today's world are that we always need to be asking and exploring, what does this mean for the bigger play? And the fact that there are sort of two different leanings between these dynasties, one slightly towards China, the other towards the United States, means that whatever way this plays out, it does impact the regional dynamic and the way that broader, bigger geopolitical match-off, standoff between America and China, the way that unfolds in the years ahead.
Yeah, I mean, those links are so flimsy though, aren't they? And they're hard to interpret sometimes in the sense that China, we know, prefers stability. What they seek is certainty and reliability when it comes to trading patterns. So perhaps the leader in the Philippines who enjoys the most support from Beijing will be the one who can promise stability. At the moment, it doesn't feel like either of them can do that. So, yeah, I think all of that is true. I'm also interested in the street level of Philippine, you know, life in the Philippines at the moment. You know, the idea that you have civil leaders, civil society leaders like Maria Ressa, as you mentioned, and Jose, talking about getting ready to go back into the trenches, right, in case Duterte, Sara Duterte, does prevail in all of this. I mean, that is a terribly chilling reality from my perspective, given what we know of what happened under Duterte, what happened under Marcos prior to that.
So, Kylie, a bit of feedback.
Yes, and briefly on Eurovision, thank you for interviewing Dean Vuletic, says Jessica. Love this episode. Wonder if we have more to learn about social cohesion achieved through shared musical endeavour. A tool of soft power seems spot on, she says to Geraldine.
Yeah, still sore about Delta not winning the thing. She was she was brilliant. And this on our Indonesia Rising series, by the way, just want to acknowledge that we have received so much of it and so much thoughtful feedback on our Indonesia mini-series. It was with a degree of trepidation that we went into putting this together because often there's not that much engagement we have found on Indonesia. And so it's been a real delight to learn how much you're thinking about it and how many views you're willing to share and ideas and thoughts. This email came from David Fife. Selamat malam, or good evening, he says. I like your program. Pleased that it's now more than once a week. I'm particularly pleased that you've been doing the series on Indonesia. I grew up in a Melbourne household where Indonesia was a very important part of our lives. My parents, Herb and Betty, he says, had lived in Indonesia in the 50s through the Volunteer Graduate Scheme, which later became Australian Volunteers International, and they embraced many aspects of Indonesian culture. It was a very important part of their lives. They both taught professionally about Indonesia, were involved with the Australia-Indonesia Association. They spoke Bahasa Indonesia and had many Indonesian friends who visited our house frequently. When I was 10, our family went to live in Jakarta for a year. My father took sabbatical leave from Monash and taught at a university in Indonesia that year. So I've been finding the Indonesia Rising series really interesting, particularly your interview with Laxmi Pamonchuk. So that was the episode last week. However, he says, on occasions, Hamish, you interrupt. Didn't let her finish her answer. Look, I have to say, David, it's been wonderful putting this series together. But yes, we do have to squeeze the episodes into half an hour. And there are questions that we want to get to and things we want to explore. So my apologies that it doesn't work perfectly for you. But sometimes we are forced into a bit of a compromise with this stuff, particularly where you have such eloquent people like Laxmi to speak to. By the way, do keep the Indonesia feedback, thoughts, questions, ideas coming. We're going to put together a special episode at the end of the mini-series where we deal with some of your questions and ideas. global.roaming@abc.net.au is the email address.
And thanks to our producer, Kylie Gray, on this episode. Geraldine and Latika will be back tomorrow to talk about a green energy transition in Africa. Is that a pipe dream and who will pay for it? Lots to learn. See you, Hamish.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.